Welcome to the So Why podcast with Step Care Solutions. This podcast aims to explore issues and challenges as well as ideas and solutions leading to strengthening support for mental wellness and recovery. My name is Alexa Bull, Director of Co-Design and Knowledge Exchange at Step Care Solutions, and I will be your host for this episode. Single session therapy, sometimes called one-at-a-time therapy, has been around for some time. It has been steadily gaining attention among providers and service delivery systems. Single session therapy can have tremendous impacts in different contexts with proven waitlist reductions and positive outcomes for many people. It is based on the assumption that something helpful can happen in one interaction. The thing is, single session therapy is an important approach because many people can only attend or want to attend one session. In fact, research shows the most common number of therapy sessions attended is one session. If a person will only engage once and may never come back for another session, it becomes really important that that one session they have is helpful. One-at-a-time therapy provides an effective option for people seeking support to address their concerns in the moment. Borrowing from this approach, one-at-a-time thinking has been identified as a core component of Step Care 2.0. This thinking considers that every encounter across the mental health system is an opportunity for a person to have a helpful experience and address their immediate concerns. Today we are joined by Dr. Heather Hare, who has a BA and an MA in psychology, a Master of Science in Couple and Family Therapy, and a PhD in social work. Dr. Hare practiced for many years as an approved supervisor of the American Association of Marriage and Family Counseling. Dr. Hare's interest in learning led to a tenured faculty appointment administrative position with a Canadian university. Her multi-decade work with children, youth, adults, and families began as a child care worker in open and secure treatment facilities for adolescents. Subsequently, she worked as a registered family therapist at an Ontario inner-city children's mental health center, where she co-created and coordinated the Brief Therapy Services and developed and supervised the Brief Therapy Community Externship. For over 25 years, Dr. Hare has been developing and providing skills training workshops on one-at-a-time counseling conversations, single-session therapy, and practice-focused supervision, as well as program consultation to providers of mental health, social, and community services, as well as faith communities. Her academic and professional interests include effective practice with children, youth, and families, supervision and staff training, the intersection of practice and social justice, the social construction of knowledge and meaning, and the qualities of helping conversations that encourage hope, change, and growth. Let's welcome Dr. Heather Hare to the So Why podcast. Thank you so much, Heather, for joining us on the So Why podcast today. We're so excited to have you.
Well, thank you. I'm excited and a bit uncertain about being here. I appreciate it. It's actually very flattering and an honor to be asked. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, we're so excited to talk with you and learn from you. Maybe we'll just start out sort of high level. If you can just share a little bit about why you are sort of drawn to a one-at-a-time approach, single session thinking in your work.
I think that's a really good place to start. There's a number of threads in my life that have kind of led me to this point. Without sounding like I'm giving you a history lesson, because I have a few decades to draw on, quite frankly. It's an intersection between the work experience I gained in the late 70s into the 80s, and then the education that I kept picking up during my adult life. I've taken a long time to grow up. I'm still in that process trying to figure out who I want to be when I grow up. And the work experience came before the sort of the opportunity to dig into the ideas. And that work experience was working in treatment centers with youth. I really thought that was going to be my career. And I did it between 1979, 1987, when women were barely on the landscapes, particularly in secure units. And I had an opportunity to work at open and closed and group home settings with teens between the ages of 12 and 18. It's the kind of work, we were called child care workers at the time, but became known as child and youth care workers, where you could be the only person who might have an opportunity in these exceptional moments in their lives, and nobody else could be around. And it wasn't a live-in role. It was an 8-hour or 16-hour a day kind of work. And professionally, at the time, we were kind of the lowest on the professional totem pole, and yet could have the potentially the greatest influence in the lives of these youth. Everything from getting them up in the morning to getting them to bed at night and everything that goes on in their lives in between. So therapeutic milieu, that whole approach to thinking of the environment as being therapeutic, was really big at the time. And I was really, really interested in trying to make the most of every moment with the youth. They could be sweeping the floor. So how do you, just having that conversation, that opportunity, because counseling sessions didn't really happen very often. In fact, I had colleagues, if I was having a counseling session, wondered what we even talked about. Like, they couldn't get their heads around it. Because many of the people I worked with at the time were large men who were kind of there almost just security and to keep things in order, because you'd be working in a house of maybe up to 12 adolescent boys, which could be quite interesting. And that opportunity, I think, really stuck with me. The chance that I had to have these potentially influential or pivotal conversations and feeling so ill-trained to do it. And having them in the moment, there wasn't the opportunity to talk about long-term or ongoing sessions. And often it was about a moment in time, about they might just come out with things. And how do you use that effectively? I had no idea. It didn't fit with any of the training I'd had up to that point. And that's kind of what was this pivotal point for me to start looking at furthering my education, because it's a pretty dead end profession in lots of ways. It's hard to move any further unless you have a degree, or at least that's what was starting in the 80s, is I had a diploma at that point. And I thought I was going to go into psychology, did a couple of degrees in psychology. Again, it became really frustrating because I felt, why are we talking about, psychology is very research oriented. But to jump ahead, I ended up getting accepted to the couple and family, what was then called the Marriage and Family Therapy Program at the University of Guelph at the end of the 80s. That was a pretty big privilege. And before that, I had done a master's in community psychology, which was looking at change at a systemic level. And really, and community psych is kind of like the outsider within the world of the fractured world in many ways of psychology to begin with. Very much at that point, focusing on prevention, the word empowerment was really big at the time, looking at people's strengths and resources, language that I had not heard in psychology. And I became attracted to those ideas, although I felt very unfamiliar with the idea of community approach. I hated sociology. I couldn't do anything in sociology because it was sort of like it was the system was the problem. And I was very much, oh, it's the individuals got to make the change and they could do it on their own. And realizing, no, every life happens in a context. And at the time, I was attending a church that was really important to me, a faith community that was struggling at that point, that pivotal point of membership where people start leaving. They've reached that transitional point. And I had the opportunity to do some research there where I got a chance to see how looking at people's needs as well as their resources could make a difference in how groups move forward. And then I got accepted to the Guelph program. And things started to come together. And I got introduced during that program to the ideas of the social construction of knowledge and meaning, which was very threatening to me from my faith point of view, because I was very happy to think that there was absolutes and there was truth and one truth. And I've learned over many years that I can have both. And there's actually one philosopher, Bruno Latour, who really supports that idea, that a French philosopher, that you can have the belief that there's multiple ways of looking at truth, but there still can be absolute truth. And this was really liberating for me over my life. And the idea that what happens now and how we view it later can look very different. And how can we use that to help change our view on ourselves and our world and the relationships that we continue to have as we move forward? The idea of brief therapy, and I was in a therapy program and I called myself a therapist, was not huge at that point. It never has been. It's been marginal all along. And I was trained at that point very much to do biopsychosocial assessments that would take anywhere between 3 and 5 sessions with families, to do clinical formulations, develop treatment plans, and then anticipate based on the seriousness, the complexity, as people would put it, the overwhelmingness and the intrusiveness of the problem could take anywhere between 3, 5, 15, 52 years of therapy. And it wasn't unusual. I worked in Children's Mental Health Center to see intergenerational families, to see people coming who had been in therapy themselves and were back to the same agency. And I was very uncomfortable with this gathering of all this information that seemed to have nothing to do with why they were coming. Parents coming because they just want their kid to go to bed quietly, or because they're misbehaving in school, or because they're torturing the cat, or they're fighting all the time. They don't, and then to be asking them things that go back to, so how was the, you know, pregnancy if they happened to be a birth child? And so finding myself questioning a lot of those ways of thinking. And at the same time, a lot of things intersected here in the late 80s, early 90s, because I got hired at that agency at that time. So solution-focused brief therapy and narrative therapy were just coming onto the landscape in a big way, particularly through the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. And it was like this amazing fit for me, this way of reorienting how I think, not that problems don't exist, but to reorient how I look at them. And at first it was kind of like, it was uncomfortable, it was weird, but I had an executive director who was quite a visionary, not a particularly good administrator. Unfortunately, that happens too often in mental health and addiction services, but a real visionary. And I had the opportunity with him, and this started, I guess, somewhere in the mid-90s, to look at how can we change the service we're delivering? And again, that intersected with what was happening economically in Ontario. And we, as human beings, I think we tend to want to go along with what we're doing. If it, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as Steve DeShazer has said. And we're not particularly comfortable with intentionally moving towards change. I believe we're changing all the time, but to intentionally make differences. And as long as the economy was moving along, it was okay to see only 5 or 6 people a week, right? Wait lists of 15, 18, 24 months. But, you know, we're doing the best we can. Ha, ha, ha. And so cutbacks started. And unfortunately, that was the context within which brief therapy got introduced into government organizations, at least in Canada, is my take on it. So it got a bad rap from the start. It's only to support the government cutbacks. It's not real service. People are going to get cheated. It's not going to address things appropriately. And you're probably familiar with that. But I want to make sure I stay with your question, because I'm getting a little bit into the content. These were ideas, the ideas of how to use time, how to take advantage of time, how not to take advantage, not to make assumptions about time, to make the, you know, continue to sustain the belief that people are going to come back. Where do we get that arrogance that we think people need to come back? Who's driving that? Just because I think you should? And particularly people don't get what they need, which often was what was happening. After 3 to 5 sessions of telling their life story and then going, now what? They're pretty fed up, particularly in children's mental health, when they might be bringing 4, 5, 6 kids on the bus for a 1-hour session in the middle of the afternoon, pulling them out of school just to retell their story, as painful as it often was. So those were part of it, looking not only at the use of time, but deconstructing, reconstructing ideas around problems and solutions, and really beginning to appreciate the influence of power in the relationships. These were ideas that got introduced to me through the opportunities I had to practice and a lot of the reading I had done, but in particular by practitioners like Michael Hoyt, certainly Monty Bell and Arnie, with this whole start of the Eastside Family Center's walk-in clinic in Calgary in the mid-90s. Actually, I think it started before that, but I went in the mid-90s to check it out. And this visioning and revisioning of solutions, it was a feeling like I had come home. And I just spent a lot of time writing and practicing and finding out that people were responsive, sometimes quite puzzled by the changing questions, but definitely responsive overall. And it wasn't about how many sessions, it was how I could have the most effective conversation possible. So I hope that gives some ideas of at least where they started. So they've been percolating with for me for probably over 30 years.
That's amazing.
If I consider my practice even before that. So.
Wow. And I think, you know, you just told about so many different experiences that kind of led to that shift in thinking and, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. Oh, that really worked really well. And something that struck me was when you were talking about your time as a child and youth worker, and you mentioned moments in time and how those moments, sometimes spontaneous, could be such huge opportunities in the lives of those youth, and could be a pivotal moment. So the fact that it's not only in a therapy session that these big changes and these big opportunities can come up. And then the idea that, what resources do you have? Because oftentimes people come in to seek help and feel like they have no resources and feel like they have nothing and feel like totally just rock bottom. Like, I don't know what to do with myself anymore. But I'd love if you could share a little bit about that, about, you know, how do we help people uncover their resources in some of these conversations, whether it's therapeutic or whether it's a moment in time as a youth worker having a conversation with one of the youth?
Well, you touched on two things for me, and I do want to get to your question, so make sure I do. I think the first piece that you've mentioned is that it can be more, that my perspective is it's not bound by the professional identity of the person that these conversations are exclusive to. That was very badly put, but and in the literature, a dominant thinking that it's exclusive to people who are part of professional associations or who are part of or identify themselves as a, at very least, master's level, graduate level, or PhD level at the most, educated person who's registered or carries that professional designation. I think we're leaving out a huge, huge potential resource, diverse resource in our communities. And there was a recent survey in Canada that was just out where people are very, that suggests that people are very, very unhappy with mental health services. And yet throughout the results of the survey, it was on CBC and a couple of other places. There's no mention of what is defined as mental health services. Nowhere. I couldn't find it. I've written the place that did the survey. They haven't got back to me. My guess is they're defining it according to the following: psychiatry or psychology, maybe social worker if we're lucky. I think they're leaving out 80% minimal of the potential workforce out there who could be making a difference in the, and are making a difference in the work they do, but are often overlooked, marginalized, and ignored by the larger medicalized focus system. And because these conversations, and I'm not going to minimize the training I've had, I realize that I've had years of it and years of experience. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. But if we're going to be talking about having an effective helping conversation, how does that change the playing field? And how does that change? And what difference does that make to the players? And what difference would it make if people in those roles could have the opportunity to just have a few, have a chance to shift their thinking? Because they're influenced, like all of us, by the air we breathe, which says that big problems, big solutions, you need professionals. And they don't have, you know, they need help. They can't do it on their own. And I don't think people need to do it on their own, but they don't have any resources of their own at all. And so that brings me to the other half of your question. I think the important thing is to really think about, what are we looking for? What does resiliency, resources, and strengths really mean to us? How are we operationalizing that? And I heard very recently, Alicia Kortnich said in a training she did that, are they breathing? You've got something to work with. I just thought that was brilliant. That if they are talking to me, or they're even sitting with me, if they're being with me, they're not dead yet. So clearly there's something here to work with. And my job is to find it and to go as micro as I need to. So how did you get yourself here? I'm really amazed you got out of bed this morning. Tell me about that. You know, who would notice? How would you explain to yourself that you're here? Is it like, is there something within you that believes that this could be helpful? If you were to listen to that part of you right now, what would it be telling you? But I need to believe. This is about me. This is an incredibly, in my belief, this work is so much about who we are and where we are in our relationship to others, our relationship to the creator, our relationship to the planet, the universe. But that sounds incredibly you know, airy fairy. And how much am I believing that this person has resiliencies and strength, that I have the hope and the expectation that something can happen in this conversation, even if I never see it?
I love the acknowledgement of there's two people in that conversation. I think we often get super focused on the person who is seeking help, who has come in to have a conversation. But the conversation is between two people, whether we like it or not. Professionals are still people. Mm-hmm. We're all people interacting with each other, and we all carry different things into that conversation. And so I like that you brought that up, because I think that that's an important acknowledgement and something that we often overlook. And so I wonder, you know, you mentioned assumptions a few times in different ways, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about positionality and assumptions when having these one at a time interactions with different folks, and how does that play into the whole conversation?
Okay. I think that when you said there's two people, I just would like to add to that. Most often I saw a lot more than just a person. And I think it's important to acknowledge that as well, because too many disciplines do the one-on-one, which takes away context. Even if I imagine the other people present, it's a step further towards seeing people in relationship to others in their lives. And I found it made a huge difference when I would see people with other people, whether it be their partner, their kids, their friends, their other family members, or in community meetings. The acknowledgement of multiple voices and multiple perspectives, and having the opportunity in a facilitated conversation to get a chance to hear each other differently, is incredibly powerful. So I want to acknowledge that the more we can see people in community and include the significant others in their lives appropriately. I mean, that's another road we could go down in another time, how we make those decisions, particularly if there's safety involved. I think the more we have an opportunity for change to continue when it's not in front of me. If I see someone in a counseling or even any kind of conversational setting, how long does it last? An hour? How often do you have lunch with somebody? An hour, maybe 90 minutes. And then you might never see each other again. People continue to live and have lots of diversity in their lives in between these conversations. And to recognize that, I think, has been a really good experience for me, that I am not the most important person in their life. The other piece, though, about assumptions, there's been a lot of work done in the literature that I'm familiar with, looking at, and particularly it's come out talking about single session thinking, looking at what are the common elements? What is it that sets what has typically known in the literature as single session therapy, what sets it apart from other psychotherapies? And I want to acknowledge that a lot of these ideas came out of that world. So I think it's important to identify them that way. And typically, though, they're about the elements common to single session therapy. So the belief that, you know, we make the most of one session, look at people's, you know, focus on what people are wanting right now, all really good ideas, and sort of what makes that session unique. And there's some other qualities that I'm not going to go into, like making the most of the hour. As Monty and Arnie have put it, you know, an hour is a long time. I admittedly, I'm not as well read as I would like to be at this point, but I have taken a bit of a different step. And I've thought a lot over the decades about what are the beliefs that inform how I view many elements in the world that in turn influence my conversations that I can have with people, or how I move and make decisions in my life. So I'm talking about constructs such as change, hope, history, future, time, power, social location. What do these have to do with effective helping conversations? I think they've got a tremendous amount to do with it. How do I understand myself in relationship to these constructs? So, for instance, something like history. The dominant belief, or the prevalent belief, is that we need to know the background. We need to know background. If I'm going to get to know you, Alexa, I need to know where you've come from, what you do, what have you been up to, what's your, you know, all that kind of that's built you to be who you are today. That's in a social situation where typically I'm meeting someone where I believe for the most part we're coming in on equal footing. You know, there's not identified positional or knowledge power differences. You're not coming to me for a particular reason. But when people are, if I'm meeting someone for a reason and a focus, such as how I could be helpful, already there's a positional power difference. So I'm like the conductor, or in, it's actually more like progressive jazz, where the lead is shared, but there's still someone who calls it when to keep it going in a particular direction. But it's not as obvious as a conductor in front of a whole orchestra. And how, if I believe the change is ongoing, if I believe that I need to have hope and expectancy for growth and change, if I believe that it's important for me to notice and recognize and have had a process time to look at my own social location by all its varying identities and notice that about someone else and think about it and talk about it, perhaps even surface it in terms of being part of the conversation. If I'm thinking that, how does this person leave knowing that they can have something, or we leave from it, having reached something that's going to be helpful for them, if those ideas informed my conversations, how would it change the language that I use? If all of psychotherapy, whether it be everything from, well, there's just so many diverse ones out there, although when you look back far enough, they're really not as different as what was out 20 years ago. They're just somehow nuanced a little and titled a bit differently. How would that influence the kind of conversation I would have? Because I have tended to believe that what I think informs what I say. And if I believe that people do know what they want different in their life, even though they walk in and go, you know, here's my problem, tell me what to do. If I really believe that they know what they want different in their life, how would that change the questions I would ask? I might not call myself a one-at-a-time counselor or a single-session therapist, but how would that change the conversation I would have? So if I, as a childcare worker or a shelter worker, believe that, you know, that person I'm talking with, they do know what they want different in their life, how can I help them to get there? What kind of questions would I be asking? How much would I be asking about history versus what are you wanting different? How will that difference look? I keep thinking one of these days I need to sort of sit down a little bit more thoroughly and think about these ideas thoroughly and think them through and think, what can I do with these? And how would they really impact therapeutic practice? So the next level I'm interested in is not the isolation of single session therapy, one at a time counseling or therapy, or even effective helping conversations, but how can these ideas influence and integrate across practices? Many of the people I've done training with have come from orientations where this really flies in the face of everything they've ever learned. Social work is still dominated, for instance, by biopsychosocial assessments, where I collect all this data. What if it meant I wasn't collecting it anymore? What would I do instead? What if I didn't believe I needed it anymore? How would that change what I ask? And so that's something I'm very interested in, is how do we help these people integrate these ideas, not for the walk-in clinics, but for all their practice? It doesn't mean we don't stop seeing each people again, but each time we see them, they become effective moments that could be helpful then, on the belief they might never come back. People don't, for lots of reasons. So that's something that intrigues me. And then taking these ideas even a step further, and this has been done by a few people, and putting them at an organizational level. How can we take these ideas about that are very much influenced by the idea of social construction of knowledge and meaning, but intersecting and integrating with the ideas out of single session therapy, one at a time counseling, the practices that are associated with them, the kinds of questions. How can organizations communicate better with each other so they're highlighting each other's strengths and resources, creating a sense of well-being and a sense of support, particularly at a time now where things are so uncertain? And I believe these are ideas that can be used in very much non so-called therapeutic contexts. Jeff Young and Pat Rycroft talk about single session as a way of differentiating it. I kind of like that idea. You know, I like to think about, it's a single session that people get stuck on though. And that's problematic, unfortunately, because then people think they can only come once. Or it's going to happen once, you know, but anyway.
What you're saying is super interesting. And I know that in some other conversations I've had with folks about one at a time and single session, this whole idea of mindset has come up. And I think that's exactly what you're describing. and describing sort of this mindset that is not necessarily limited to a therapy session, but could be used in different ways across different sectors just to try to be helpful. And I think it's so interesting, that whole assumption that I might never see this person again. So how can we get something out of this conversation that's really helpful and productive while we're together? And that doesn't just have to apply in a therapeutic situation, but could apply in different circumstances.
I even use it with friends. You know, we're talking, I mean, you want to make sure you're not sounding like you're therapizing them or something, but, you know, just that whole, you know, people just, you know, you're starting to listen to the story. And I've sometimes said, are you just wanting to have a chance to vent, or do you really want some advice? That's a game changer question, because I just want to vent. And that I go, okay, I can just sit back and listen. Because sometimes it just makes us feel better, but don't expect advice at the end. And I need to hold back, because we keep thinking people want advice when they're not ready. They're not there. They really just want to vent, and because they're stuck and they're not happy, but they're not ready to look at doing anything about it. But this could be the first step towards that, if they just felt that someone heard and was present with them. But too often as human beings, we're right in there going, have you tried? Well, what about? What are you doing back with them again? Didn't we have this conversation just last week? You know, how often does that happen with friends? These are ideas. I've had people who have gone to training that I've done come back and talk about how they've tried it out on their kids, and they can't believe the amazing difference it's made. And just in the conversations they have with family members. So yeah, I think they're ideas that are, their time has come to be going beyond, and yet acknowledge the different levels of intensity, or the different levels of perhaps complexity, or the different levels of service delivery that might be going on. And I think we have lots of potential opportunities at Step Care Solutions to start exploring those venues.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing today. I think I always love chatting with people about these different topics, because I get a different glimpse and a different sort of perspective on the same subject. And so I really value what you've shared and the experiences that you've shared and the perspectives that you've shared today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the chance to do that. And who knows what I'd be saying if we were doing this tomorrow.
That's right. Could be a different podcast.
That's right. Could be very easily. Thank you, Lucia. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you once again for joining us on the So Why podcast with Step Care Solutions. For more information on the Step Care 2.0 model, as well as links to resources mentioned in this episode, please check out the show notes below. Thanks for tuning in once again. We look forward to having you back next time.